Welcome to Indie Radio Garden, this week's highlights from community radio in the Philadelphia region.
This program brings ordinary citizens to the air to discuss issues related to health, race, safety, workers' rights, and the will to survive in pandemic times.
This week's show falls on the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa Race Massacre and is dedicated to the victims of that terrible day in American history. The show is also dedicated to the memory of George Floyd, who was murdered 1 year ago this week. The first piece of audio is from WHGE LP, 95.3 Afro-American Historical Society of Delaware. Scrap Radio's Pavel Uranga interviews Mr. Harmon Carey, founder of WHGE, about the experience of growing up in a society that does not accept you because of your skin color. Racism, racial discrimination, and white privilege are the topics of the first part of this interview. We will present the interview in two parts.
Welcome. We are interviewing Mr. Harmon Carey from WHGE LP 95.3 FM from Delaware, from the Afro-American Historical Society. And we are doing this interview to feel and take some minutes on empathy to understand what is the feeling about grow in a country who doesn't like you.
That's a good way to put it.
Talking about racism, I'm talking about racial discrimination, I'm talking about hatred, and I'm talking about the personal way to live on a particular skin. As you know, Mr. Harmon Carey is a Black man, and myself, Pavel Uranga, I'm a Mexican, indigenous, and with Black heritage too, and both as feeling this hatred and this racial disparity in our own skins in different ways. We are here to talk with Mr. Carey about how is grow from your child experiencing this hatred because you are a Black person.
Well, let me start by saying I was born in July of 1936, before World War II started. And when I was about 8 years old, 7 or 8 years old, before the war ended, I was playing with some of my friends and learned that these men who were under guard at a grain company on East 4th Street in Wilmington, and by the way, I was born on East 5th Street, were German prisoners of war. Okay, now, we felt like they were the enemy. So we would go by and torment them from not a close distance, but from across the street where they were unloading freight trains. I believe the name of the company was Purina Chow Company. And it was grain and animal feed and stuff in burlap bags. I know not what they all were, but seed, I would think. But anyway, we would throw stones at the prisoners, and because we wanted to help our soldiers. We're just little kids. And they called us Swatza swine and some other choice words that I can't remember that were in German. Well, I went home to my mother and asked her, "Mom, what's a Swatza swine?" And she said, "Black pig." So they were calling us black pigs. And I guess that was the first time that I encountered, and though I didn't realize it anything, but racism. from these German prisoners, who, by the way, I was told later after the war, some of them actually stayed and lived in Wilmington. Also, there are several faces of segregation that we didn't realize was segregation, though we experienced it. We just thought it was the way things had to be. For example, when we were just young children, there was a playground at 5th and Pine Streets in Wilmington. It ran from 5th and Pine all the way down to 4th and Pine. And the playground would not permit us to play. We couldn't come into the playground when it was open. We always had to go after it was closed, after the white children left and they locked the gates. We would climb over the fence and then we would play in that playground. The playground opened at 9 in the morning during the summers, of course, and it closed at 5. But as I said, it was for white kids only.
About the schools, how works the things in the schools, in the public schools? It's segregated. It's the same for everybody. You went to a special school?
I went to public schools in the city of Wilmington. And there were a lot of differences, Pavel, between what was available to us as students, from something as basic as textbooks. I never saw a new textbook. We always received textbooks that were used and handed down to us from the white public schools. There were no white teachers at any of my schools from first grade through 12th. I didn't come in contact with white students until I went to college at Central State, then college, now university, in Wilberforce, Ohio. The books that we had, they were talking about the Wright brothers flying the first airplanes. And the school books that the white students had were talking about jets, you know, breaking the sound barrier. And they reflected two different eras. And it was, you know, beginning to dawn on me as just a young student. And I began to feel the difference and wondering why some of us were so disappointed and disillusioned at the conditions at Howard High School that we wanted to go to another high school. And the high school that we wanted to go to was P.S. DuPont. I mean, it seemed like a castle to us. And we saw these students because we did play sports, basketball and football, and ran track against them. So we had a glimpse of the accoutrements that they had, and we could make comparisons between what they had, their uniforms, their athletic equipment, and ours. Just one quick example, like our football team didn't have helmets for everybody. So whenever there was a substitution, the guy coming out, if he played in and he came out, he took off his helmet and gave it to whoever was going in to replace him. Well, we saw that that wasn't happening. We could look across the field, and that wasn't happening with the white schools. I know that when I ran track, we had to sometimes trade, let's the other fellow on the team for his event wear our shoes. We began to see, or at least I began to see, hey, things aren't equal. Now, I learned later, Pavel, the advantage that we had and was that we had Black teachers, and those teachers loved us and encouraged us. Though I have to say to you, I didn't come to that realization until, you know, after I graduated from college. Then it just seemed like not the place to be. Students who came to school early in the morning by bus from Newark and from Delaware City, students who left home, and they told me this, Harmon, when we leave home in the morning, it's dark. And when we get back home, it's dark. There were no freeways during those times. So that was just the reality. And Wilmington had, there's a term for it. It was like you're being segregated against, but you don't really know it. I mean, it wasn't any viciousness, any, you know, attacks on us. It was like you're being segregated against, but it's with soft hands. So it was almost like they knew that they shouldn't upset us.
I was thinking about the intentionality of the provide that kind of education to the Black kids. It's always because they don't want to create an intellectual generation of Black people. They want to have workers, and workers who can read and write to be functional and nothing else. That's why this kind of disparity of the quality in the education, providing ancient tools instead the most modern books and with the most modern content. The intention was creating all a generation of workers and not the generation of people who can help this country to grow.
I'm sure that that kind of thinking prevailed. Pavel, before we leave education, let me comment about the way that schools were for Black students before we had buildings that were built of bricks. We had old wooden shacks where students went to school. And a man named Pierre S. DuPont, who was the president of the DuPont Company, built a statewide system of schools for Black students. They were, for the most part, one-room schools, but they had a stove. They had lavatory facility. They were modern in comparison to what the students had to go to before he built those schools. He is the only example of a philanthropist who built a statewide system of schools for Black students. There are some examples in the South where citywide or countywide schools were built. But the only example in education history that I'm aware of where a philanthropist, a single philanthropist, built a statewide system was here in Delaware. And those schools, I was involved in an effort to restore one of the schools, and I learned a little bit about the history from some of the students who went there for elementary school. The teachers had six grades in one room. They taught six grades. And I said, well, how could they do that? And here's the way they did it. They would have an aisle for the first grade, an aisle for the second grade, an aisle for the third grade. And while she was teaching the first grade or something, she gave the other aisles going up to grade six work to do. And then she would go to that aisle and teach them. Now, I cannot believe that under those circumstances, the quality of education that those students received was equal to the one where that kind of grouping together didn't exist. But some of these students went on to Howard and eventually caught up, and they went to, many of them went to college and became teachers themselves, I'm proud to say.
And that's because the people has very powerful intellectual knowledge by themselves. Yes. And they take everything and take advantage of this poor basement, but solid and beloved basement provided by caring and loving teachers. Yes. And they learn and they take that and they give it back as teachers, and they have this amazing experience. I'm amazed about the society in that time, because everybody knows that things happen, but no one wants to talk about that. I mean, from the white side on the block. And the people realize there are Black neighborhoods, Black schools, and Black laboratories, and Black places to drink water and black restrooms and black something else. But they don't care about that. Why these things happen? How these not normal things happen? Because everybody thinks this is normal. This is the way we do the things. And that's the wrong way to do the things. That's the way to grow and develop the white privilege, how the white people doesn't care and doesn't realize about the inequality, about the disparity, about the racial discrimination, and use that advantage on their own behalf to take more from the society, even wages.
From the show Planet Philadelphia, 92.9 FM WGGT LP G-Town Radio shares audio with us. The hosts, Kay Wood and Linda Rosenwein, interview Tyke James, Government Affairs Coordinator of the National Audubon Society and co-founder of May 2020 Black Birders Week. He talks about the experience of being black in birdwatching, the risks of the activity due to racial discrimination, and white privilege.
I'm Kay Wood, the host of Planet Philadelphia, and Linda Rosenwein, our assistant producer reporter, has worked with me putting together this show for you today. Our guests today are Tyke James, the Government Affairs Coordinator for the National Audubon Society and co-founder of Black Birders Week.
Hello, Tyke. So nice to see you.
So happy to be here.
Do you want to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. You hit on the present day. So I do work at the National Audubon Society. But before that, even maybe 2 years ago before I got this position, I was not thinking about a career in environmental advocacy, much less at a large environmental nonprofit. I went to school for math, computer science, and teaching. I was convinced I was going to be a math teacher. But I was actually never really that good at math. However, I had a job, a side job, working at the Copps Creek Community Environmental Education Center as an assistant manager for an education program that recruited high school youth, a program that I went through and was then promoted to. And that's where I also started my love of birds, where it was a job where I was a public educator, speaking directly to folks about going into the park. And I realized that I wasn't seeing the birds if I wasn't also looking at environmental conditions and, you know, the lack of streetlights, park benches, and trash cans are something that I saw in my, you know, beginner birding world. And the understanding that the center at Copps Creek was built in 1937 during the Works Progress Administration. And, you know, up until the 80s was used as a horse stable for the police officers in the park. And coinciding with the MOOF bombing that happened now 35, 36 years ago, that community, that zip code, that part of the neighborhood of West Philly, you know, became a target of systemic neglect. And when I started working there, it was my understanding that it is the effect of police brutality and violence on black and brown bodies that presents a cultural and a time-bound and even a physical barrier to going to the park. Because before it was a park, it was a place that you didn't go. And you knew it was a place that you didn't go because you've seen or heard something that happened there. Somebody else would tell you, your parents then will tell you, and then you tell your children why not to go to the park. And so my understanding of birding was really an understanding of history with my neighbors and a history of the park and a history of the city. It wasn't until I got a random call from a state representative, that state representative being Representative Donna Bullock, who wasn't so random for me. I was a big fan of her work. She offered me a position to be her scheduler. Then when she saw that I was an environmental educator for a couple of years, and that for me, it was an understanding of connecting people and nature, she saw that that's also pretty good to have somebody advise you on environmental policy. And through that office, I met a lot of environmental advocates and realized that a lot of that field, mostly white people, that didn't make that connection that I saw so clearly between the environment and people, public health and environmental conditions, or even the history of people in neighborhoods and public health. But again, I wasn't interested in seeing myself into that career until I got an offer from the National Audubon Society. Now I live in DC, native lands of the Nacogdoches peoples, where I similarly do bird walks, meeting people where they are, understanding, you know, the history, the place, and understanding the conditions of the environment where I'm birding. But now I do it to organize bird walks with members of Congress and with congressional staff. I used to have monthly bird walks on the Hill up until I broke my ankle last January, and then coronavirus. And now the insurrection this January, there's not a lot of folks doing bird walks or doing much of walking around on Capitol Hill.
Tyke, you just brought forward so many different issues. It's not just that you love birds.
Well, I mean, birds are as avian as they are also very terrestrial because they land on branches. They exist in habitats that I walk to or have been driven to. And I think that an understanding of birds is an appreciation of Earth. In the same way that you understand birds, you're understanding history, you're understanding and making connections with people.
Last year, there was a Black Birders Week. So maybe you could tell us why that was.
Absolutely. I think a big reason that Black Birders Week occurred and had such an impact that it had, I think, are twofold. One reason is that when the Black experience was part of the national conversation after the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery, a lot of what folks were focusing on in the Black experience was trauma, which is true and historic and can be seen in a lot of ways. However, Black Birders Week saw that the Black experience goes beyond trauma, that it includes joy, pride, resilience, strength, and style. And the 6 days of programming, but the 7 days that week, was very much dedicated to forwarding that narrative. And the second reason that I believe Black Birders Week last year was so special and so impactful was that it was local in so many places. You know, it was local to anyone who was on Twitter or Instagram primarily, saw the hashtag and saw fellow Black birders and saw birding groups with statements of solidarity and some that went further to actually act on those. But it's interesting to think about now about a year from it last year, where those organizations are and what they have to say now, considering their strong statements, their strong support, their strong actions, and to see now this year if that's led to any significant changes. And so when I think about Black Birders Week, I also think about how the outdoors community should be a lot more reflective of the diversity that it seeks to be a champion for.
I understand that sometimes Black birders or naturalists, they face challenges. Why do you think that that is?
The short answer is white supremacy. The long answer is the status quo. The status quo is the thing that makes folks feel comfortable when they think that they're making progress. But the secret of the status quo is to confuse, pacify, and normalize itself. And the environmental movement, this country, let me say, in particular, a lot of the environmental movement started as a white supremacist, anti-immigrant, patriarchal-based activity, project. You know, you can look at John Muir, who started the Sierra Club. You can talk about John James Audubon. John James Audubon may not be the founder of the National Audubon Society, but he himself is an inspiration of the namesake, and he himself held enslaved people as property to do his birding bidding. And if we do not consider that as part of how the environmental movement started in this country, then it'll be harder to answer that question of where is this discrimination coming from? You know, discrimination is just a practice of this white supremacist notion that the environment and thus its benefits will only go towards certain people. And when we can look today at the contemporary environmental movement, environmental justice and environmental racism are always, for some reason, playing second in the, oh, also that, when we're talking about climate or when we're talking about environmental effects. It seems that the folks who are hurt first and worst are always second to be considered when we are trying to achieve environmental progress. And the root cause of that is the normalization and the evolution then of white supremacy in the environmental movement. Now, I'm not saying that people are walking around throwing out racial slurs. White supremacy is not just racial slurs. It's also the imbalance of power. It's also the perpetuation of inequality. It can happen, of course, in the movement in a lot of visible ways, but there's a lot of internal ways in organizations. For example, a lack of transparency in compensation perpetuates pay inequality. And pay inequality disproportionately affects Black women than anyone else in the workforce. And so if we are trying to achieve an environmental movement that provides benefits for all people, we should make sure that the people who are in that movement are also getting paid for that work equally. Because when we don't, then the progress that we are achieving becomes progress for folks who've already had privilege, and it becomes progress for folks who don't want to be treated or feel the experience of a minority. Because even the idea of climate anxiety is one that has, I feel, mostly pictured in predominantly white climate conversations. Because the idea of living like the first and worst and most marginalized creates some anxiety. But the reality of those Black and brown bodies already existing, already persevering, surviving through the climate crisis, predates the idea of climate anxiety. It predates the pushes for global warming. Those effects and those voices have not only been underheard and underserved, but also underrepresented when we are thinking about what counts as environmental progress. So when we think about discrimination on the interpersonal level, we have to see that it's also connected to an institutional level of who has been included and excluded from the environmental movement.
What I wanted to ask you to end with is, what message do you want to leave the listeners with about Earth Day?
I hope in the observation of Earth Day, people take a moment to think about what it took to get here, who has not made it here with us, and what it will take to truly make an Earth Day that's worth celebrating globally.
Can you say a little bit more about that?
I don't think we're making environmental progress if we're not dismantling white supremacy and anti-Black racism. I don't think Earth Day is a full celebration of the global community if we are not achieving environmental progress for the global community.
It's been absolutely delightful talking to you, and I really wish you well in your new endeavors.
Yeah. Well, I have plenty.
Thank you so much for all the deep thought you put into these things.
I'm always happy to help.
Thank you for joining us. My name is David Juro, and I'm the radio news coordinator of WRGU-LP, 92.9 FM, Germantown United CDC. Indie Radio Garden is a Prometheus Radio Project production.